Welcome to the Unconventional Dyad Podcast, where you'll find broad topics, an unconventional dyad, and one shared goal, educating ourselves through challenging and engaging conversations. Your hosts are Carly and Laura, two graduate students and friends committed to having discussions that are real, raw, and unpolished. Thank you for joining us.
Everyone, thank you for tuning in to episode 5 of the Unconventional Dyad Podcast. We are absolutely thrilled for this episode where we talk to Carlos Padron. Carlos is a Latinx licensed psychoanalyst and an advanced candidate at the Institute for Psychoanalytic Training and Research, also called IPTAR. He originally studied philosophy in Venezuela, then earned a Master of Arts in Philosophy with a concentration in psychoanalysis at the New School for Social Research, and finally a Master's of Philosophy in Latin American Literature at NYU. He has written and presented on the intersections between philosophy, literature, psychoanalysis, and Latin American thought. He was a teaching fellow at NYU, a faculty member at J. John College, the Contemporary Freudian Society, and the China-American Psychoanalytic Alliance. Carlos is currently a faculty member at IPTAR, where he co-teaches a class on clinical aspects of diversity. He also teaches a seminar on psychodynamic theory at the Silberman School of Social Work in Hunter College. Carlos participated in the documentary Psychoanalysis in El Barrio, a film on working psychoanalytically with underprivileged Latinx patients in the U.S., and has given talks and published on this topic as well. Lately, he published an essay in the edited volume Psychoanalysis in the Barrios by Rutledge in 2019, has an essay on whiteness and the good white, in a special edition of Division Review No. 22, dedicated to COVID-19 and racism, and was invited to write an essay for a special issue of Psychoanalytic Psychology, tentatively titled Notes from a Pandemic, Reflections from 19 Clinicians on the Year of COVID-19. Carlos has worked psychoanalytically in different settings and is currently a clinical associate of the New School Psychotherapy Program, where he supervises PhD psychology students. Today we discuss a whole lot of topics, and I really hope you get to listen to the whole episode because we talked about a lot of different things. But just to kind of highlight a few different topics, we talked about his experience being a forced immigrant in the United States, the whiteness of psychoanalysis. We also talk about misattunements and missed opportunities with the other, both inside and outside the frame of therapy, and really how these experiences provide space for growth for everyone involved. We also talk about good whiteness, and I don't want to give too much of it away because I really think that you need to hear it directly from Carlos. So I hope you enjoy the episode, and thank you for listening. So Carlos, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm so excited, and I know Laura's excited to have a conversation with you. So would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about you, describe a little bit who you are, how you identify?
Cool. Thanks for having me. I've heard your podcast. It's really interesting. You have some interesting conversations, so I was looking forward to meeting you. So thanks for having me. A little bit about myself. I'm originally from Venezuela, South America, and I've been here in New York City for 15 years. I am an immigrant. I came here to begin with, wanting to study, but then the situation in Venezuela got so dire, so difficult, as you might know, that there was no turning back. So I was just kind of like what I thought was going to be some years here in the U.S. ended up being 15 years. I have to bring my family here. So, I can speak a little bit about that, the life of the immigrant, and many times the in my case, the forced immigrant, right? Because there's no turning back. So I came here, my background is originally in the humanities, in philosophy and literature. And then I'd always been interested through my own analysis, but also then intellectually in writing about psychoanalysis and its relations to philosophy and to literature. And then as I was doing my PhD in literature at NYU, I think it was a little before I thought that, look, I needed to train or else I wouldn't to train as an analyst or else I would not really know what I was talking about. So I started a 2-year respecialization program at IPTAR for people who don't come from the mental health field. And then you have a little bit of clinical experience. And I gave myself 2 years to kind of like test the waters to see if I was interested. And I was, it was life changing, you know, the experience of being with another person in a setting in which of such intimacy and closeness and emotionally charged and listening to people just really blew my mind away. It's like unlike any other experience. And I said, look, I really want to do this. So I applied for training. They accepted me, which, you know, it's not usual. Normally, it's mostly mental health practitioners, social workers, psychiatrists, psychologists. So back then when I started, it was a little bit of a strange bird, so to speak, because my background was in the humanities. So, and then I just kind of like switched from academia to just being full-time practitioner, though I continue my intellectual endeavors through other ways, not in academia, but still writing. I still teach. I teach at Hunter College in Silberman School of Social Work. I teach at IPTAR, a class on clinical issues of diversity. So I've continued, you know, the intellectual pursuit through other avenues, but now in a different way, which is more experience-based, unlike what I did before in philosophy, which I thought I was always missing that experience and human, that lived experience that you have as a psychoanalytic practitioner or as a therapist in general. So that blew my mind. It really changed my life. It was like an after and a before. It changed my view of philosophy, of literature, of many, many things that we can speak about. And then as a Latin American immigrant, I became more and more interested in working with communities, Latino, Latino, Latinx, Hispanic communities, however you want to call them, and trying to work psychodynamically or psychoanalytically with them, which is rare in people of color, especially disadvantaged people of color in mental health clinics or agencies, as they're called. That's not the treatment of choice. So I wanted to work on that way, and then to write about it and to show that it's perfectly possible to work psychodynamically with that population or that group. So I've now dedicated most of my work and my clinical and intellectual work on that and issues related to psychoanalytic issues related to race, culture, ethnicity, gender, all things related to difference, which is a theme that I find very important and very, very close to the psychoanalytic spirit, which is the thinking about difference. So I don't know. That's maybe, I don't know. I could continue talking, but maybe you have some questions. So I identify myself as, now I would identify myself as Latino or Latinx. It's been a trip because when I came here, it's the first generation immigrant. I identified as a Latin American. I was aware of course, of the Latinx history and struggles, but I thought that I could not really be part of that or inherit that because I came, you know, I'm a newcomer. I would always identify myself mostly as Latin American or say I was from Venezuela, but through time, through my own personal history of immigration and all the struggles that implies, that we could talk about some of them if you want to. Plus, together with the way that I'm thought about, right, the way people think about me here, they think of me as Latinx or Latino, not Latin American. So these two combinations of things have changed a little bit my own sense of identity here in the United States. And I think more and more as myself as Latino or Latinx. So, you know, it's given me a insight into how identities are very, you know, change so much depending on context. And they're very fluid and very much based on experience. So that's the way I think of myself at this moment. It might change, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. I am also a first generation immigrant, Carlos. So I was pretty excited to talk to somebody in the field who also identifies that way. I'm wondering if maybe you can tell us a little bit about how you think your immigrant identity has informed your psychoanalytic work.
Oh, I think deeply. That's a very good question. I think that there's a poet who says that only a foreigner can show me my own foreignness, or another way of translating would be only a stranger can only show me the stranger that I can be to myself. So I think that a psychoanalyst is always in that position of that, you know, that foreigner or that stranger who shows to you, or the client, the patient, the analysand, however you want to call them, that those aspects of yourself that are foreign to you, that are alien to you, what we call the unconscious, right? So I think that being an immigrant, it puts you in that position of already before being an analyst, you're an analyst of sorts, right? Because you're already the other, you're already the alien, you're the difference. So you're always seeing things from another perspective, from the other's perspective. So I think it gives you an insight into these processes of being, again, of things being other or alien or different. It gives you an insight into that, or some sense or some ability of kind of like doubling yourself, right? Being a double. Because you're like an insider of the culture, but also an outsider. And I think that's a very peculiar, that's kind of a little bit how, at least I think of myself when I'm in the analytic situation. I'm a participant, of course, very much engaged in a relationship, but I'm also seeing things from another perspective. So that's one way of thinking about the experience of being an immigrant. The other is just more related, more concrete, is working again with people who have been othered or who have been suppressed or invisibilized. Most of my practice are people of color, I would say like 90%. And so it gives me an insight into what it means to feel othered or being invisibilized or suppressed or feeling like you don't belong, that you're out of tune with culture, that you're not contained by hegemonic social discourses, that you're outside, you're an outsider. And I think that's how psychoanalysis began, right? It used to be called pejoratively the Jewish science, in a pejorative sense, right? Because it stemmed from a deeply anti-Semitic culture. So was born as the other, right? They were the analysis and the Jewish analysts were the others. And that's something I think that we've forgotten a lot, especially here in the United States, where psychoanalysis became so, especially in the 50s, so mainstream, so medicalized, so institutionalized, so white in many. There's a very interesting paper called Why Psychoanalysis Became So White in the United States. it has to do with many things. We can also talk about it, but it lost some of that, its origin as being of the perspective of the other, which was the Jewish perspective, right? So it was kind of like, someone says, the Jewish was the Black person of Christian Europe. To finish this, answering this question, there's also not only beginning from the position of the other, but being interested in things that were marginal to the psychology of the time, right? Freud builds up a whole theory based on what other people thought of as unimportant, scientifically unimportant, namely dreams, slips of tongue, mistakes, errors, all kinds of things that were considered unscientific. And he built a whole theory on things that were marginal. I find that also very fascinating. So it stems from a marginal position, and from the position of an other, and it is about things that are marginal and that are other, but that end up being the most important thing, seriously, right?
Carlos, that really got me thinking about our training. So Laura and I are fourth year graduate students in clinical psychology.
Okay.
And I think a lot about our training and how we really don't talk about otherness. We don't talk about being unknown and how to be more known. It's not something we talk about. And I know that you had maybe had some interest in talking about misattunements, making mistakes in therapy. That is something we don't talk about enough in our training. And I'm wondering if you can share a little bit more of your experiences or your ideas around misattunements, mistakes, kind of, I guess, helping students understand that it is really okay to make mistakes and really how to overcome that.
That came to mind when we spoke before, because I read that when you presented your podcast, you said that you wanted it to be very raw and show your mistakes and everything, which I think is very courageous. And it's a very, I would say, a very psychoanalytic stance in many ways. So there's many ways to answer your question. Let me see. One thing is, if we connected with otherness, right? And what you said, like this lack of thinking about otherness in your training, right? One way of thinking about otherness in relation to misattunement is that several things come to mind. One is that when we're talking to other people, especially people who are more different from us, right? When there's different or more salient differences, such as related to class, to gender, to sexual identity, to ethnicity, et cetera, we might not be, our words might not be interpreted or understood the way we want them or the way we intend. And that on the one hand. On the other hand, we might not be seen the way we think we are being seen, right? So that's one aspect that's important, right? That some people, when they don't think enough about otherness and difference, they don't think about how what I mentioned before, kind of like that doubling effect or that doubling strategy and analysis, that you have to think of yourself the way the other person is thinking about you. I think that's an essential thing. A more concrete way of thinking about that is that when we make an intervention, it's not only important to make the intervention, but to perhaps ask how the intervention is being processed or is being understood. Something that I often ask my patient is that, well, how did you hear my words? How did you think about them? How? Because it might not have anything to do with the way I intended, right? Especially when there's more salient differences between the analysand and the analyst, or the client and the, there's many ways of calling the other, right? Let's call the other person. That's one thing. So there, that might be a source of misattunement, right? Because you're working under the assumption that you're being known and seen and understood only in the way you're thinking about yourself. So it can be quite, unbeknownst to the therapist, a very self-servient or even narcissistic way of thinking about them ourselves, right? Because it's easy to fall on that because, you see, it's a part of us that thinks of ourselves, well, we're helping people, right? So it's difficult to think of, to connect the idea of us being helpers with the other, not necessarily finding ourselves or what we mean or what we pretend helpful at all, or the way we want. They might not think of ourselves that way. So that might be a first source of misattunement, right? That we're not being thought the way we think. The other source of misattunement might be in relation to the person that we're seeing, right? And that could be because the person is very different to us, or the person is very similar to us. It can be in regards to sameness or difference. Let's think, for example, in terms of difference, right? The other person might be from another culture, where the other person might have very different ideas of what it means to be in therapy, of what it means to have an emotional conversation with somebody, or what it means to, for example, I used to give you something more concrete, I used to teach a class at the Chinese American Alliance it's like a project that teaches psychoanalysis to Chinese candidates who are interested in analysis. I used to teach them, and we used to talk a lot about the differences there and here in relation to therapy. It has changed over the years, but in many Asian cultures, you know, talking to a stranger can be a source of great shame, or it can feel like you're betraying your family. There can be values around not talking about your feelings and just, you know, sucking them up. It can be a sign of strength. So we can't assume that, you know, oh, you have to open up and talk about your feelings. So there might be different ideas of what it means to heal, what it means to talk to somebody, what it means to develop, to grow. So these are things that we can't assume, and that I think it's important to be curious about with the patient, and curious in the simple way of just asking them, right? If we don't know, we can't assume that we know everything, right? So we just have to ask. I have patients I have patients that are immigrants, and I ask them, you know, how is it like to, what does it mean in your culture to date, for example, or what's the role of your family in the dating, et cetera, et cetera. So to be curious, if there's no curiosity in relation to the difference, again, it can be culture, it can be gender, it can be class, it can be many things. That can also be a source of misattunement, right? Because we are working again under the assumption that whatever theory we have in mind is so overarching that it makes us feel safe that we're, you know, that anybody we work with should fit within that. So it makes us feel safe, but it can be many times reductionist. I think that I think is radical about psychoanalysis and the way I think about psychoanalysis, it has to have a radical openness where experience always is in excess of any theory we might have. About mental functioning, about technique, about anything. These are guidelines. These are not strict rules. So we can't try to force the other's difference into our theories or into our assumptions. So that's one way of connecting otherness with misattunement, right? And then the other person can feel deeply hurt, can feel that we're re-traumatizing them, right? That we're at another level, even with all our good intentions of helping them, we might be re-traumatizing them, right? One example that I give many times is, for example, I worked at a mental health clinic for 3 years as a full-time psychotherapist, where I did psychoanalytic psychotherapy, mostly people, Hispanic, Latino, Latinx people, working class or poor. And there's something, right? There's something in these clinics that people who are there, they do a lot of very good work and very difficult work, underpaid, with an excess of patients, too much work, bureaucracy. You're a therapist, but you're also a caseworker at the same time, underpaid. It's terrible for the practitioners, and it's terrible for the patients, because then they're not getting the best care that they could receive. But one thing is that you might want to help this population. And then since you feel impotent, because you are going to feel that, oh my God, therapy is not enough. What they're going through is complex social and political and economical situation that, you know, is in excess of what I could do as a therapist. So you want to go the extra mile and do too much. And then you might become some part of you might become, want to save the other person, or you want to do too much and you start doing things for the other person, and you start, and then at the end, it comes because you want to help them, right? But you end up without, unbeknownst to yourself, infantilizing them. And then you start telling them what to do. And so you repeat at the level of therapy the same kind of social and political suppression that they've been through in society, right? So that's, and that's trying to do a good thing, right? So I think that's why you have to be mindful of you know, again, going back to what we were talking about, that's a case of misattunement. Because what you think the patient needs is to become their savior, or to do everything for them, when what the patient needs is probably, you know, somebody who can help them develop a sense of agency or of autonomy. So then there's a total misattunement with the patient, right? That's another example. If I can continue, I just want to start talking, but you can stop me at any moment you want, okay?
This is great. I'm really enjoying this conversation. So
the other source of misattunement is in regard to well, before I mention that, there's one a source of misattunement can be when you don't let the person articulate what they're going through, their pain, their suffering, in their own words. For example, there's many, going back to my experience at the clinic, right, with Hispanic, Hispanic people, you've probably heard that many, it's not only Hispanic people, I'm using Hispanic, I know there's differences in what Hispanic, Latino, Latinx means. I'm not going to get into that unless you want to. So I'm just using them interchangeably for the sake of simplicity now, right? But I know there's differences between them. But there was this group of people, also in the Mediterranean, there's what it's called ataque de nervios, or like a nervous breakdown. It appears in the part in the DSM on culturally bound syndromes, right? Which means that, let's say, somebody dies, or there's a divorce. It's normally related to some form of loss. And then people start exhibiting these symptoms of that look a little bit like a panic attack, but it's there's a performatic element to it that is more it's a public display of pain and distress. So an ataque de nervios is unlike a panic attack in that You can have a panic attack in the solitude of your room, but you'll never have an ataque de nervios alone. That would be, as an analyst says, like a misuse of the attack, because part of the use of the attack is the social display of pain and suffering. By the way, you would never go to see probably a psychiatrist for this, right? They'll give you a tea or something, right? But the reason I'm mentioning this is that maybe if a patient comes to you and they say, oh, I'm suffering from anxiety and my mother died and I'm having these symptoms, and then you tell them, oh, that sounds like a panic attack, right? Let's suppose you say that. Then the patient, instead of telling you that what they're thinking of is an ataque de nervios or this culturally bound way of experiencing that distress, they might say, yeah, it was a panic attack, right? And then that's a misattunement, right? Because the patient is acquiescing to your way of your way of seeing their distress, right? So so I think that's another way of being misattuned, right? By not letting the patient speak and articulate things in their own words. So that's the last thing I wanted to say about that. But there's another area of mistakes and misattunement, which is when we work with patients who are very narcissistically vulnerable, right? Who get hurt easily. The so-called, you know, borderline patients or narcissistic patients, right? We speak about that in psychoanalysis too, not in the same way as in psychiatry. We talk more in terms of character formation and structures, or narcissistic structures, borderline structures. Like, for example, Otto Kernberg has lots on personality structure, on borderline personality structures. But to make things simple, in both cases are people who get hurt very easily, right? Very hurt very easily, whatever comment you make, right? So a lot of the treatment, one form of treatment, at least the self-psychological form of treatment, which is different from what Kernberg does, which is the transference-focused psychotherapy. But let's suppose we are like more Cahusians and we do self-psychology, which means that you just allow the patient to make them... They make you part of their narcissistic orbit. They make you what is called a self-object, where there's no difference between you and them, right? You've maybe had experiences like that, where you're in the room with somebody and it's almost as if you could simply not be there. It doesn't make a difference. So in their mind, there's no difference between you and them, right? There's no difference. But, so you don't say much, right? But, So in that sense, by becoming a self-object to them, you created the possibility, right, of them slowly being able to tolerate little bits of difference more and more. And how do they come? They come in the form of misattunement or empathesis, right? Not because, and this is not a technique, this is not that I'm going to say something wrong to make the patient react. No, it's impossible for you to be absolutely the same with a patient, right? There's always going to happen a comment you make. It's happened to me even with one patient that I was unaware that I was moving my foot a little bit, and he would tell me, oh, you're moving my foot just like my mother. You're so impatient. You don't want to be with me. I wasn't even aware I was moving my foot, right? So it doesn't even have to be something you said, right? So that's a misattunement, right? What does that mean? That I introduce a difference within this narcissistic bubble of the patient that is experienced by them as an attack, right? And then what do? Well, we talk about it. So what was it about it that, you know, you got really angry at me? What was it about it? It seems like you experienced me the way, you know, you experienced your mother. What happened there? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then this experience of of working through this, let's call it this misattunement, is internalized by the patient, right? Kohut calls it a transmuting internalization, which means basically, like, to put it simple, the patient is internalizes a little bit of a containing capacity that comes from the therapist, right? And the patient is able to introduce or internalize a little bit of difference, right? A little bit, they could tolerate something that's a little different. Now, next time I move my foot, it can be a little more tolerable to them, right? So that's a case in which a misattunement is an opportunity for change, right? And that's something that Kohut talks about, Winnicott talks about. He talks about, what did he say? He says, we succeed in failing the way the patient needs us to fail, or something like that, right? Which means that these little misattunements, these little mistakes, even in our interpretation, are within a contained, safe environment, a holding environment, right? That probably the patient never had that kind of environment. The patient is slowly able to tolerate them a little more and more, and they do something with it. So we fail them the way they need us to fail them. So in that sense, failing, making a mistake, it can be an opportunity for growth. Maybe grow. I hate the word growth because it's too developmental. Let's say for change, something changes. Well, I'll end with another example. A patient of mine who was a person who complains a lot. So lived in a world where everything was a source of disappointment, right? No matter what, that's the issue. Well, that's part of the issue of being a neurotic, right? There's the what would be the word? The inflexibility of the symptom, right? That no matter what happens, the world is always different. Things are always different, but no matter what happens, you make the difference the same. So even if you get a raise, like this patient, you get a raise and you say, yeah, I got a raise. Well, but it wasn't the raise that I was expecting. And she gets very, very sad and very hurt and starts complaining, right? So she complained all the time for a long periods of time. And I listened to her. There was not much I could say, except, you know, process a lot of, I think of the anger and the aggression that was behind our whole complaining. And I started to get also very angry and frustrated, right? I was saying, like, oh my God, we're like stuck here with this complaining and this negativity. And no matter what I say or don't say, doesn't make a change, right? So there was one session. So that, like, you know, you tell me there's a student, and I think this is important for a student to hear that, in the sense that we're all meant to make mistakes, and it's going to happen. This is what happened to me. I was going to tell her, you know, you told me last week something that she used to say, right, all the time. So I was going to tell her, you told me last week. Instead, I told her, you told me next week. So talk about a slip of tongue. And it's like, the nightmare of any therapist is to have, you know, have a slip of tongue with your patient, right? And I was like, oh my God, I the minute I said it, and she caught it. And she listened and she told me, I said it to you angrily. I said it to you last week. I'm saying it now. I'm going to say it next week and for a long period of time. Right? So why am I giving this an example? It gave us an opportunity to talk about the anger and the aggression behind all her complaints and her negativity, right? So it was an opportunity, right? If I had said, oh, I'm so sorry immediately, I'm sorry, that would be like the first impulse, right? We wouldn't have not had the opportunity for her to just get very angry at me. And I just let her be angry. What's the use of me telling her, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it? At first, it would have been a lie because at some point I did mean it, right? That, hence the slip of tongue. Unconsciously, I did mean it. So it's like, I don't mean it. That it would have been dishonest to her. So I didn't. So again, sometimes you do have to say sorry to a patient, right? I think so. We could also talk about. But other times, saying sorry is not necessarily. It's kind of like telling the patient, shut up. You can't be angry at me, right? There's no space for that, right? Or sometimes if it really hurts the patient, I'll just let it be. And see what develops out of that. And then I might at the end of the session or some moment, I would say, look, I'm really sorry I said that hurt you. I could say that, but not immediately. Because if I say it immediately, it's defensive on my part. It's because I don't want to hear something from the patient, right? I don't want to hear their anger. So again, to close this part, a case in which a mistake, or in this case, a slip of tongue, which can be seen as some form of even of misattunement, because she didn't feel like I was attuned to her complaints and her negativity at all, was an opportunity for some movement and a possibility of talking about a lot of suppressed anger and aggression. So yeah, no, I don't know. I'll stop there so you to see if you have any comments or questions.
It just got me really thinking, you know, the last few minutes of our conversation, there's a really interesting parallel process happening between, you know, otherness and needing to really fit into a mold, kind of this narcissistic investment, and training institutions and, you know, training programs. And you teach at some training programs. And I'm curious if you experience kind of this institution, you know, this kind of institution as forcing others to fit into a mold. And I'm kind of wondering if you can speak to that. I know this wasn't really on the plan to talk about today, but just kind of training programs in general and feeling like as a student, I definitely feel like I have to fit into a mold. And I do feel othered quite a bit, despite being in the majority, you know, racially. I do still feel very much othered in my current training program.
You feel othered because you have more of a, like, in what way?
I think a lot differently than a lot of other people, and I don't feel comfortable enough bringing my ideas and disagreements into classrooms, into supervision. And I guess just training as psychoanalytic training institutes, I do feel very, I've just been hearing that people feel very similarly, needing to fit a mold.
Well, I think it's, you're right. I think there is a, let me see. I have no idea. Well, I have only heard secondhand about people who are doing PhD in psychology. I know secondhand with through colleagues. I also supervise PhD students at the New School at their clinic, so I know through them a little bit or a lot. Yeah, there is a trying to fit a mold, definitely. But I know less than what I know in analytic institutes. I think analytic institutes have a lot of investment in certain theories, certain ideas, certain identities, aware of being. That's why, you know, psychoanalytic institutes, even since beginning with Freud, there have been so many divisions, right? Because people are so, become so invested, the word you use, right? So narcissistically invested in their own theories and their own ideas that it's very, sometimes very difficult to have a sense of pluralism when it comes to having different ways of thinking. It's almost as if some analytic institutes, they felt that if they opened up, even theoretically, let's not even talk about in terms of having people of other races or ethnicities, right? Just theoretically, there's this sense that we'll lose what we have. We'll lose an identity. Or psychoanalysis as we know it will become unrecognizable to ourselves. So then we will become unneeded or something, right? I think there's a little bit of that. So I agree with you. I especially, look, me coming from the humanities, from philosophy and literature, where my usual default position is to argue and to not take things at face value and to ask questions and to be, you know, a pain in the ass, basically. And where you just have discussions all the time about everything and you don't take it that personally. I found that in analytic institutes, interestingly, people don't like to discuss that much and they take things very personally. I was like, oh my God, I'm so what? You can't have just like a conversation. Everybody takes it personally, like we're attacking each other. Like, I'm not attacking, I'm just disagreeing, right? So it was difficult for me. My case, so what I decided very consciously was that since I had no clinical experience at all, and that's something that I had to learn, and that I did learn from by being at an institute, I decided to more or less shut my mouth for like a year and just absorb everything that I could.
Just 1 year.
I said, let me say, like, wait like a year or something. But slowly I said, well, I started, you know, bringing up some issues and this or that. And again, I can't generalize. Sometimes it was well received. Other times, the thing with analytic institutes sometimes is that if you have theoretical disagreements, they'll say, well, they'll tell you, well, you know, you don't know what you're talking about unless you have that clinical experience, which I think there's some truth to that, but it's also used defensively, right? Because I think you have to be able to make your arguments and defend your position, not without saying, you know, you can't say you don't know what you're talking about unless you have this experience. I don't buy that either. I think that experience is very important, but you must also be able to talk about things in a way and in a clear way, without jargon, without technical terms, which I detest more and more, to just make sense to yourself and to other people too, and be open to difference again. So again, there is this sense of trying to, I don't think they necessarily do it consciously, but like this sense of like, we have to belong to this group and, or else we're going to lose our identity. That's something that I've experienced. So as with anything, I think it's important. I mean, people who want to train, it's like to look, I have a student, an ex-student from Hunter, who now started analytic training not at the institute I'm from, and another one. And she was telling me exactly what you were saying, that she was feeling already at the beginning that it was too like claustrophobic for her, that she was kind of like feeling too, you know, was like the space was too small for her, right? And I was talking to her and I said, yeah, you know, I had that experience too. So I think a lot of the experience with any kind of training is that you have to learn a lot, and then there's a long process of unlearning, I think. and then where you just have to figure out, you know, several things. One, what's the way that I want to work? Because that's something that an analytic institute is not going to tell you. And I think you have to find your way of working, your own voice. In it's inevitable, and I think it's needed, and it's a lifelong process, I think, number one. And the other thing I think you need to do is to kind of like remember who you were before you started training, right? There's something that's always curious, right, that all very experienced analysts say, is that the so-called, which I hate that term, but I'll use it for so it makes sense, so my what I'm saying makes sense. The so-called difficult patients, right? Which I prefer, like more perhaps demanding patients. Let's say patients who suffer, let's say borderline patients or psychotic patients or very more troubled patients, right? Interestingly, the younger therapists with less experience tend to be better therapists to them than the ones with more experience, because they're more open, they're willing to go the extra mile, they're not so fixed on trying to use this technique, that technique, this way of working, that way of working. They're just trying to find something that works and communicate with the other person. And normally they'll be the best thing that could have happened to that person, right? So I think that's why I said we have to remember who we were when we started training, right? And have that candidness and that openness together with, you know, the experience and the things that we've gained, right? So I think we can't lose that. And remember that I started like this Instagram where I write some kind of like a diary that I write. When I thought, you know, I wrote that we can't forget that life is larger than psychoanalysis and then therapy. And then when in doubt, you know, don't try to resort to a technique or this. No, it's just, if you don't know what to do, keep in mind, if you're just one person in front of another person trying to talk and have a conversation and trying to do your best at understanding them, I think that's the basic. And you're trying to listen and understand. And, you know, and no technique, no sophistication is going to save you from that struggle and that difficulty, right? And we can't, I think it's important not to forget that. And so, again, to answer your question, yes, there is that closeness sometimes, trying to mold people into certain trends of thought or schools of thought. And it's become, and I'm only talking theoretically, if we go and talk about the, in terms of racial or ethnic difference, you know, psychoanalytic institutes are super white. There's a long history of why they're so white. One reason is why, because they became medicalized. They became part of the psychiatric establishment when it started here since the 30s, more or less. And the psychiatric establishment, as the medical establishment, was deeply racist. It had small quotas of black people and women that, or people of color that they'd accepted into medical training. So one reason why it became so white is it was because it became medicalized, which is was from the beginning a very white profession. That's one reason. So again, it's become, so I think that's why we need people from all avenues of life, not only in terms of race, ethnicity, but, you know, queer people, everybody to come and feed the analytic spirit, without which I think analysis will die. I think that's the future of psychoanalysis. It's dead. You're bringing all the people, all this this difference into analytic institutes. That's the only way for it to remain alive and more and truer to its origins, which was very anarchic, very experimental. Just think about Freud, how he was at the beginning, right? Experimenting with hypnosis. And then I'm reading a book called Radical Psychoanalysis, an essay on free associative practice, which I find is very interesting. And the author, who's from South Africa, so it's Radical Psychoanalysis. The author is called Barnaby Barrett. And he talks about the radicalness of free association. Right? Mm-hmm. Just letting somebody speak about whatever they want to speak about. How radical is that as a form of treatment as a form of interaction between one person and another? So in its origin, psychoanalysis is very radical, very anarchic, right? There's nothing more anarchic than free association in a way. So I think, well, you know, I don't know if that answers your question. It might. So I agree. I agree with you. And we can't remain closed. We have to open up to all experiences. Like, for example, intergenerational trauma, a concept like that, comes from the experience of Jewish people, Jewish analysts, right, that brought it to and made it part of psychoanalytic theory. And now an analyst and non-analyst talk about intergenerational trauma. So what if, imagine, other people brought their experiences, how richer our theories could be, right? Mm-hmm. Our theories about how people think, how they act, people's minds would be super richer, much richer. It's just one.
I'm reminded of a quote, I think that you said on another podcast maybe, or in the El Barrio documentary, I'm not sure, but you made a statement saying that psychoanalysis is meant to be inherited by marginalized populations. And as I'm listening to you talk right now, that's kind of the quote that's coming to mind. I wonder if you want to expand on that a little bit.
I think so. I do think so. I mean, psychoanalysis, thank God, eventually became, well, all kinds of psychotherapies, they're mostly women. We know that. Thank God. I think that's a very, 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 very positive thing that it's in mostly in the hands of women, this profession, right? That's one thing. But besides that, we need also other people who have been, well, like women, who have been marginalized, definitely, right? I'm talking about people of color, queer people, working class people, poor people. I think it's about several things. One, to remain, I think, I'm saying also white people, everybody. I'm not excluding. I think everybody, right? I mean, it has to be everybody. I mean, I also believe that white people have lots of valuable experiences to bring to psychoanalysis, right? Everybody, right? I'm talking about that. Probably I'm being a little, what would be the word? I think that we have to, in another place I once said that a mainstream psychoanalysis is a contradiction in terms, I think. And it doesn't mean that I don't think psychoanalysis should be more relevant in culture, in politics, in political discussions, in political activism, in the way it is in Europe and in South America, where psychoanalysis is very much part of the culture, right? You always see, you know, there's like a TV show, an interview about the yellow vests in France, and then they'll have an analyst, a philosopher. They're part of the culture, right? Like philosophers are, right? There's like a Edith Piaf song where a philosopher appears, right? So it's part of pop culture. And here, the analysts have become very secluded within their institutes, and they're not part of culture. So I'm going to answer your question. I think that opening up and to difference, that's what I'm calling, like in people who have been minoritized, excluded to inherit this, means psychoanalysis to become also more engaged with culture, with politics, with social justice, with activism. And I think, you know, there's, we have to also inherit the plight of those people who have been invisibilized and who have been marginalized. That's how psychoanalysis started. I think we have to inherit that. And inheriting that is not like we say, okay, now all of a sudden we're going to just have, you know, more Black people are institutes. It's a work that we have to do. It's work. Inheritance is a form of working. It's not something that we say, I inherited this money and now it's mine. How do we inherit that? We inherit it by engaging with those communities, by reading about those communities, about reading their histories, about writing about them, about opening up. I think there's something paradoxical, and I'm going to say something unpopular, but I don't care. There's a paradox there's a lot of conflicts that I have with identity politics. One thing, I understand it deeply, and I think it has a very important political function, and it has produced gains in through people grouping through identities and finding protection and finding common causes and everything. So I understand that fully. But as anything, and as an analyst, you have to think that everything has, you know, a flip side. It's not, it's complex, it's overdetermined, right? The part of identity politics that is, it's shadow, I think, if we want to think about it in those terms, is that I think we've become very close to ourselves. You know, we close based on our identity, on who we are, on our group. We've become very protective. I understand why, right? Mm-hmm. Why special people who have been attacked, you know, they have to protect themselves around identity. But I think I'm missing a little bit of like more old school politics, of just radical in your faceness. That's what I like about Black Lives Matter, because I think that group is not that movement is not just about include us. No, it's about first. I think I like in your faceness. They're out there, right? Exposing themselves, talking to people, opening to people, right? And they're trying to create, now I just went on a tangent, right? On a ramble, right? But, and they're trying to, in my opinion, it's not about including Black people, or it's not about inclusion and diversity, which those terms I hate. It's about creating a world in which Black lives matter, right? That's a more universal and more open project, which I really adhere to. So I miss that in your faceness and that openness. And I think that as psychoanalysts, we are always a little, or must be a little, suspicious of identity, a little bit. That's a part of psychoanalysis, I think. We understand the need for identity, of course, but we also understand how identity can be a defensive formation against difference and against the anxiety produced by difference and by otherness, right? So I'm going to back to what you're saying. Inheritance means that radical openness, openness to be misunderstood, misinterpreted, to be hurt, right? I was always now with the new, after George Floyd's death and the protest that ensued, there was this, I wrote this paper on whiteness. I think I sent it to you. It was like this manic movement to action of like, and one online article that I read was like 75 things you can do to become anti-racist. It was like this manic thing, like now I'm going to read all this. I'm going to do the work. So it's like this mysterious work that you have to do. It's almost like, okay, I'm going to go to my room and read and really think hard. And then all of a sudden I'm going to become anti-racist because I have a lot of work to do on myself. I, in my opinion, that's not the model. The model is you have to go out and you have to meet people, talk to people who are different than you, expose yourself to being misunderstood, to making mistakes. That's the thing. Now it's like you can't make a single mistake because everybody, you know, there's like no room for mistakes. And I understand how mistakes can hurt people. Again, I'm not against that. To be clear, I understand where it comes from. But I think that it's important that we're open to that radical openness is to, again, that we're gonna, in trying to be anti-racist or in trying to inherit the plights and the struggles of people who have been marginalized, we're gonna make mistakes, we're gonna fuck up, we are going to get hurt, we might hurt other people. But what's the other, if it's not that, what's the other option? What, to just remain in our little bubbles of safety and where does that lead us to? I don't know, I'm worried about that. I understand the need for safety and for all that, but I'm also worried that where is that going to lead us to? So I don't know. That might be a little unpopular, but I understand the need for that, and I defend people in their identities and everything, right? But there is a flip side to that, and that's a part that worries me a little bit. And I think maybe analysts were the ones who are meant to do that type of work for people who can do that, for people who have been so hurt that they can't, you know, again, I mean, speaking against myself, right? That's another thing. Now let me criticize what I just said. Maybe allowing yourself to be hurt is a privilege, right? Not everybody can have the privilege to be hurt because people have been hurt so much that they say, no, I'm not going to get hurt again. So maybe analysts who have a training, or we should have a training and being open, and it's going back to what we were talking about before, having a patient, I make a mistake and having the patient yell at me and say, I'm very angry at you, and you understand that, maybe we can help in that, right? We can be open in a way in which we might let people be angry at us, attack us, whatever, and do something with it and transform it into something that might produce some change, you know? Yeah, it's true. That's an argument against myself. Being able to be hurt, allowing yourself to be hurt, is a privilege. There's people who can't afford that. So it's a complex thing. It's a complex thing. But inheritance is a work, I think. And you have to listen too. That's the other thing, right? Part of inheriting is listening to. Like if you go to, you know, Black Lives Matter movement, you know, listen to the, you know, Black people and what they have to say. Or you go to a women's march and I'm a man, you listen to what women's experiences are and remain open. Don't be defensive. Don't think again that, no, just forget about yourself for a moment. And just see the perspective from the other person's perspective. There's a richness there, right? And maybe you might make them your own too, in your own way. So I don't know. I just rambled there, I think.
No, that was really beautifully said. And I do want to make sure I mention on the podcast for our listeners, the article that you cited that you recently wrote, it's called 6 Inconclusive Notes on the Whiteness of the Good White. I just read it last night and it's really wonderful. Do you want to tell people maybe where they can find that? Or we can also put it in our show notes. I think it's a really important piece.
It's on the last number of Division Review, which is the what's it called? It's not even a journal. It's like a magazine or that from Division 39, which is the, Division 39, which is the division of American Psychoanalytic Association, which is of psychoanalysis. So it was a special number that came out that was originally going to be only about COVID, but then there was the killing of George Floyd. And then they made a special edition that combined COVID with racism. So they invited me to write there. So I guess you can just Google Division Review. And it's the last number. I think it's number 22. I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, I think you're right. And we'll put it in the show notes too, so people can find it. I think it really touches on a lot of the points you made about maybe the dangers of identity politics. And it just really opened up my mind to a different way of thinking. So thank you for writing that.
And also on the side of, and this is the thing, right? The identity politics also on the side of white people, right?
Right.
Not only on the side of other of the others, right? Of the people who have been othered. And how white people might use identity politics to idealize and exoticize the other. That's what I call the good whites, right? Not the bad whites. Nobody has a problem identifying them, right? That's like they say Ku Klux Klan, alt-right, openly racist people, etc. But there's other subtle ways in which the other can be distorted by not what I say there, not by being less, but by being more, in the sense, by a certain idealization, right? So it's the person who says, in this kind of like inflated way, I have this black friend, or I have a lot of black friends, etc. And again, it's like this idealization of the, let's say, a black person, that one is going to reflect good of you if you're close to them. And on the other hand, if you receive their recognition, if the black people or the person of color says, oh yeah, you're really helping us, it kind of like satisfies a form of narcissism. It makes you feel good, right? I think that's part of also of identity politics. That's a part of a dynamic when we only think in terms of identity, right? And that comes from the side of the identity of white people, right? That's something that is not spoken about in identity politics. There's also an identity of white people. We normally think of it in terms of the identity of the ones who have been othered. So that's something, I guess, to write about a little more, about that identity.
It's so funny, Carlos, because I think about that. I identify as white, and I also think about that a lot. Despite you saying that we don't talk about it enough, I sure think it a lot, especially now that I'm going on to internship and we have to write these diversity essays. I spend so much time thinking about how I want to word things to not sound like that, that good white, that I'm kind of utilizing my experiences to better my, chances of getting into an internship. So I think about that a lot, despite us maybe not talking about it verbally. We surely think about it a lot. At least I do.
It's really cool that you think it's very important. It's somebody calls that self-supervision, right? I think we need to, as therapists, continue to supervise ourselves without our supervisors. To think about those things, right? That we can also, again, I think I mentioned it there. People who have, let's say, attacked, colonized, suppressed others, they've had all the good intentions. If you think about it, right? The colonizer who came, let's say the Spanish colonizer who came to South America and, killed a bunch of indigenous populations, and they Christianized them, right? They thought they were doing the right thing. And they were doing something good to them, to the indigenous population, by making them Christian, et cetera, et cetera. What's the saying? The path to hell is paved with good intentions, something like that. So it's sometimes in trying to do good, I want to focus on therapists. We might not know that we might be using the other person, or I always have to be careful with that, especially when, since I've been interested in working with the population, writing about it, I have to be mindful of that, because I'm also sometimes feel like, well, am I using this to like further, my career, or like, I think about that too, and I'm very open about it, right? So I want to problematize that also to myself, because you do, and you have to be honest to yourself that you gain some kind of narcissistic satisfaction by helping anybody, and second, by writing or publishing or talking, et cetera. So how do you manage that, and how do you insert that within your general project of being a therapist? What's the place of that? And how might it interfere or not interfere in your clinical work, which is, I think, it's most important. One thing is like your public persona, et cetera. I might care less about that, but I really care is about, well, how is it affecting my work with the people that I'm seeing, right? So that's an important thing to bear in mind all the time. And I think it's good that you're thinking about it. What else? That aspect, right, of you seeing the other person and assuming that you know what the other person needs. Mm-hmm. Or what I mentioned in the paper, inventing sometimes needs in the other to position yourself as the savior or the only one who can help them, right? We have to be careful with that, because sometimes going back to understanding difference, one of the first things that we have to understand, I think, in treating a patient is, what do they understand by being helped? And how do they want to be helped? We can't assume that we know it. I once heard Patricia Gerovici, who's a Lacanian analyst and appears in psychoanalysis in El Barrio. She said in a talk, sometimes we can beat people with kindness, right? Mm-hmm. Let's say, I'll give a simple example, a depressed person, right? The worst thing you can tell them is everything is going to be okay. Tomorrow's another day. You'll make them more depressed. That's like Psych 101. And that's what normally people will do, right, who are not therapists. Well, but I think they're thinking, in those cases, unconsciously, they're thinking less about the other person and more about themselves. They're saying that in order to calm their own anxiety about having a depressed person in front of themselves. So ultimately, it's a form of self-soothing. It's like saying, you know, when you say tomorrow, everything's going to be okay. It's like you're telling yourself, everything's going to be okay. This person is going to stop being sad. They're not going to kill themselves. You know, so many times we say things to soothe ourselves, but not as which is really in the interest of the other. So it's good that you do that exploration with yourself, right? Mm-hmm. And we need to do it, everybody. If you're white, non-white, you'll do it thinking it related to your whiteness. I'll think about it in terms of me being a Latino, Latin American person who's from a different social class from the patients that I see. There's a big difference. There's a difference in my case is that I'm a man, or I self-identify as a man. So what about when I work with people who don't identify themselves that way? What's the power differential? You know, we all have to think about it, right? Where there's somebody who's two things that I have in mind. One, going back to this kind of like this fantasy we have now in politics of everything, like everybody being in their bubbles and everything having to be like almost aseptic. Like we don't, there's something about nobody wants to get their hands dirty anymore. There's something about that, which I connect now like to the virus even more, right? Mm-hmm. There's something about it getting infected. And I think that we all have our hands dirty. Everybody has their hands dirty for one reason or the other. Some more than others, of course, right? We're all in this with our hands dirty. That's the first thing. Meaning the hands dirty is that nobody's pure, right? There's no purity. There's no moral purity. There's no perfection. And the second thing, more related to therapy, and I think related to that, and that's once a supervisor told me, if things don't get messy in therapy, you're not really doing therapy. If everything goes too perfect and this or that, there's something wrong. Things have to get a little messy. Another analytic writer puts it in another way and says, if nothing happens in the therapeutic process that you didn't expect, then there's something wrong. There's something wrong going on. So again, it's to say, don't be afraid for things to get messy and confusing and things becoming unexpected. That's part of the therapy. If it's all tidy and nice and pure and this, there's something wrong. Mm-hmm. I think so. Mm-hmm. And in therapy and in life too. Imagine a relationship with somebody, right? Everything's so perfect. No, there has to be some messiness. And I think in politics, there has to be messiness too. Because nobody's pure. Nobody's pure. Of course, the ones on top, they're not pure. We all know that. but also the people who we treat. And that's the difficulty in treating the other as a real person and not positioning ourselves as in this condescending way that is through idealization. It's like the idealization of poor people. Poor people are not pure either.
Yeah.
If we think of them as being pure, I think we're not treating them just as people.
Mm-hmm. That's really profound. Yeah.
Right? We have to treat them as people. Mm-hmm. And people meaning they have very good things, very bad things. They're full of conflicts, of aggression, of love too. They're confused. They're enlightened at times. And they're doing the best they can. And there's a point beyond which we can't help them.
Yeah.
And I think that's the important thing to distinguish between when we're refraining from giving help to another person. We have to learn as therapists, and I think as human beings too, but especially as therapists, to distinguish between when we're withholding care and when we reach the point beyond which we can't go because it's another life. Mm-hmm. And that's tough to learn as a therapist, because sometimes we did everything we can, but ultimately, it's another life.
Yeah.
And there's a point beyond which you can't go. It's another life. It's like, there's a limit to that. Mm-hmm. And I think if we don't respect that limit, we can't do our work as therapists. We have to respect that limit of that, going back, that it's a different life. Mm-hmm. It's a different person. If we don't respect that, I don't think there's any therapy possible.
This might be a good place for this question. And, you know, we're getting towards the end of our podcast and episode. And I really just want to share, you know, how much I've learned just talking with you, even in the short time that we've had together, truly. And this question might seem a little bit weird to ask now, but, you know, our podcast is about learning and growing. And I'm wondering, you know, what is one lesson, whether it's in your personal life or your professional life, that you learned this past year, and really what impact that lesson has had on you? It's been quite a year.
Oh my God. Yes. What a year. No, that's an excellent question. And that's a good question to end. I want to think that I've learned a lot. One thing I've learned is, especially connecting it to working, one thing, right? Because there's many, but to make it short, or you see that I don't make things short. I think it's that I spend so much time silent listening to people that when I get the chance to speak, it's like I compensate for that.
Same. I do that too.
So one thing that I learned, I think, through COVID, right, and working at a distance, with, you know, all these hours on Zoom or on the phone, especially on Zoom, right? When you have that glimpse into other people's lives, right? You probably have seen people and they're at home, sometimes in their pajamas. You see their dogs, their kids jumping around, you see them in their natural habitat, right? So to speak. And something that I learned is this, was my sense, I think, of modesty as a therapist, right? One thing is that people have a life beyond therapy, right? Mm-hmm. Therapy is not the only thing, right? Mm-hmm. I hope not. they have other lives. They're doing the best they can with what they have, right? That's one thing, that modesty. The other thing is that a lot of people in seeing me, I'm here at home, right? And, you know, I have here my little, people can't see it, but you can see it. It's like my little corner where I work, where I see my patients, where I try to keep like a same place where I meet them. But they know it's my home, and sometimes they listen to my dogs, and my dog will jump, and they hear something, or they hear a siren. And for some people, it has humanized me in very important ways, right? Other people who have or need to idealize me, it has been like a blow to their idealization. It's like, oh, Carlos is just a person, right? And it has made them feel perhaps very unsafe, right? Knowing that I'm just a person. But let's talk about the people who have felt humanized by me. I was in a group conversation with some other analysts, and they were telling about the experience of how they're, in general, many of their patients were feeling that they were more human again, right? Because they saw a dog, they all of a sudden hear like a baby crying, etc. And I asked them the question, and I still have the question, which I related, I want to answer your question, which what have I learned? And I said, so it takes a pandemic. What does it say about psychoanalysis that it takes a pandemic to make us more human, right? What does it say? What are we doing? Are we doing something wrong? I guess I still have that question, right? I don't know if it's the right question, maybe. Maybe it's not. But I wonder, and it relates to that humility, right? That we can't forget that the patient and me, we're in this together. The pandemic, since we're all both living the same thing, there's a shared trauma, too. Mm-hmm. We're both isolated, alone, anxious, etc. It gave me a deeper sense that we're both in this together. When you're with a patient, we're in this together. I knew that, you see? But there's a deepening of that. You can know something intellectually or experientially, but this deepened my sense of how much I'm in this together with the patient, in the relationship, in life, in culture, in history, right? That the therapeutic relationship is not, I always use this phrase, Borges, who's a Argentinian writer, in a poem he says, I've mentioned it before because it was very salient for me, a poet who is about to die, he sees his books in his bookshelves, his library, and he had this revelation that books are not only a reflection of the world, but also a thing added to the world. And I think that psychoanalysis is not only a reflection of the world, it's part of the world. We sometimes forget that when we're behind closed doors, in our private room, it seems as if we're like in a little bubble. And I think it's important that it becomes a little bubble, because we need that, you know, that safe space that creates it creates a space of a potential space or a space of play where, insofar as action is inhibited, there we can think and talk about things that otherwise would be very dangerous. Lowell talks about that. But also we tend to forget that we're part of a world, a larger world. And that was very humbling to me. Very, very humbling. And it really deepened that sense of how important history and culture are an integral part of the therapeutic process. And that was very humbling to me. And also in regards to, you know, the play that my own suffering has in the treatment, and you know, it made me like, again, it's not a revelation. I don't believe in these like revelations. Well, maybe in poems there's revelations, and that's why they write it. But it was simple. It's like, we're in the process. We're in this together. That's the first thing, because we're part of a world. But also the difference, because I have patients of different socioeconomic status, that there can be a fantasy that we're exactly on this together. And that's also false, right? All of a sudden remember something that I left hanging from what we were talking before. is the dangers of sameness, right?
Mm-hmm.
That there's a shared trauma with our patients, but it's not the same. It's not the same if you're Black, brown, poor, working class than if you're not. So you can't forget that there's a difference between you and the other person, and that it's a different life. So that's something that this pandemic has taught me, and then, which is related to, you know, being more open to just our vulnerability, our helplessness at times, our not knowing what to do, our confusion, and that's part of life, and that should be part of the treatment too, I think. We can't fully dispel that, because it would be like, what? Like making something artificial, right? Therapy shouldn't be like an artificial product. It's already weird in its own way, right? Because the other is doing most of the talking. But one thing is it to be a little weird, but a different thing is to make it something artificial, something disconnected from life. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I learned, that, and it had a humbling effect on me, mm-hmm. I think. And that this unexpected things happen. That's the other thing, right? Who would have known that this pandemic was going to happen? We're living something that nobody has. Well, there's been pandemics before, but not televised, right? And we saw it unfolding as it was unfolding. That's unheard of before. So. Mm-hmm. The unexpected happens, and we do what best we can with what we have. And then we have to be flexible, especially with therapy, right? I had this conversation. I'm also sometimes tired of Zoom. It tires me a lot, right? I bet it tires you too. But there are some people who were very strict. It's like, no, there can't be an analytic process this way, blah, blah. And I was telling them, look, I think that's bullshit. I don't know if we can curse here, but
you can say whatever you want
nonetheless. But you know, it's Shelley Bach, who's an analyst that I really admire. He says analysis can be done in any way. You just have to find a way in which one person can talk to the other. You can do it on Zoom. You can do it walking on a park, maybe. And that flexibility, that was also a learning thing.
Or even with Freud writing letters, snail mail.
writing letters. The other day I went to there was this presentation. You were there, Carly, where there was somebody who presented a case where it's a mother and they exchanged text messages, right? Who knows? Mm-hmm. Why not? And that's part of the process too. So some like older analysts are very resistant to technology. And I think, again, there's a lot that's lost in here in virtual mm-hmm. treatment, but it doesn't mean that you can't do a treatment, right? Mm-hmm. And I've had patients who have had, who have their treatment deepened by doing it via Zoom and via telephone. And we've been able to talk about things that otherwise they hadn't been able to talk about in person. Mm-hmm. Who would have known? I would have proposed, I said, look, let's do a phone session for 3 months.
I have experienced something very similar with a few of my patients. Unbelievable intimacy. Unbelievable. Yeah. It's been quite a difference working virtually with some patients. Some not so much, but others, it's gotten considerably more intimate doing virtual. Mm-hmm.
So who knows? Maybe the future is, you know, you can, I'd say, you know, we have to be, I think, a little bit more going to what you're saying, putting things in a box, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think like an old school analyst would say, oh, let's do this, what I'm about to say. What if not in the future you see somebody in person and then you say, well, the next 4 months we're going to do it on phone and see what comes up. And then we'll touch base in person. Why can it be like a mixed treatment?
Yeah.
Why not? Who says that? What? I mean, there's no rule written that it can't be. There's no rule that says that that's not psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. So again, being flexible is the other thing about the learning. Mm-hmm. You have to be flexible in life and in treatment too. And flexible. When patients one described the treatment with me, he said, this is like controlled chaos. I remember he said, there's flexibility, but there's also stability within the flexibility, right? Mm-hmm. Well, we meet every week with the patient. And I think that has been very stabilizing for a lot of people that I see, that the world is falling apart, right? But they know that they always see me each Tuesday at such and such time. And that's one that's very, so again, the flexibility with some sense of, well, what we call a frame, right? I think the frame is also important, but the frame can be, can be the digital frame. It can be, it can be a letter that can be a form of frame. A walk in the park can be a form of framing things. You see, so the frame is not, it doesn't have to be an office necessarily. There's now community psychoanalysis, right? Where people, psychoanalysts go to schools, go to here, there. The frame is, nobody says what the, it has to be an office, right? You know?
Yeah, very true.
So that would be my answer, flexibility and humility.
Yes. I love that. Well, Carlos, before we end, where can our listeners find you online? I know you mentioned you're on Instagram and we follow you, and I just have to put it out there for the listeners. You have some very poetically written posts. I think they're really beautiful. Where else can listeners find you?
No, that's where I have the my Instagram account, my Psychology Today profile. I don't have a website. And I have just stuff written online but anything that I write, I have a paper that I'm writing that's going to come out next year in psychoanalytic psychology, where they invited some clinicians to speak about their experience of COVID. Mm. I think it's called, it's like 19 clinicians, on the year of COVID or something. So they invited me. And I'm writing a paper where I'm trying to connect COVID with racism through the signifier, I can't breathe or we can't breathe. So that's what I'm trying to put together. So, you know, just look for me online. I have stuff there. I'm in the Psychoanalysis in El Barrio documentary, which sadly is on PebWeb, which is paid. I don't like it to be paid. But that's the case. And on my Instagram, I can't remember. I think it's Carlos Padron Psychoanalysis. You guys know better. Maybe I can look
for, I think you're right. Yes.
No, it's Carlos Padron Psychoanalysis, right? That's it.
Perfect.
And basically there. Yeah, I don't have a website, so.
Awesome.
So yeah, and then yeah, you can follow me there. Write to me, whatever. And that's about it.
Great.
In terms of me.
Well, thank you so much for your time and kind of your knowledge, sharing it with us. And I'm really looking forward to staying connected and continually, you know, reading what you put out there. So thank you for being with us today.
No, thank you for inviting me very much. I hope it is helpful to the people who are listening to you. I know there's you have students of psychology or people of interest. I hope it was helpful to them in some way, and that I communicated it the best I could without using all the lingo and all the that stuff. Keeping it, I don't think it's even simple. It's just like keeping it human, I think, right? So I thank you for inviting me. I hope you're the best with your podcast. I think you're doing a good job.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to episode 5 of the Unconventional Dyad podcast. This Thursday, we are releasing another interview, this time with Dr. Claudia Luiz, who is a psychoanalyst and a writer in New Jersey. So we're very excited about that episode. And then we also have an upcoming episode with Dr. Valerie Hazanov, which if you listen to episode 4 of the podcast, you'll remember Carly and I spoke about Dr. Hazanov's book, The Fear of Doing Nothing. And so we are going to have him on the show to speak about his book. So we're very excited about that as well. If you like our podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review. It really helps to get the word out there. And if you'd like to support our work, you can find us on Patreon or you can support us through the Anchor app. Thank you.